May it please the court, I'd like to introduce to the court Theodore Mervis, who, with the court's permission, will be arguing for the appellee today.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Rob Saunders from Skadden Arps for the appellant. I don't have the privilege of presenting argument for the appellant this morning, but I do have the pleasure of introducing my partners, Robert Zimmett and Susan Saltstein of the New York Bar, who've been admitted pro hoc vice.
Welcome to the court.
Mr. Zimmett will be presenting the argument for the appellant.
Good morning. Robert Zimmett for Martin Marietta. We are here today, the day before Vulcan's shareholder meeting, to ask that this court vacate an injunction the Court of Chancery entered, which prevents Martin Marietta from pursuing its efforts to acquire Vulcan, including by giving Vulcan shareholders the opportunity to elect four independent directors tomorrow. We find ourselves in this position because the court below found that Martin Marietta had violated a confidentiality agreement with Vulcan as part of its efforts to pursue an acquisition of Vulcan. The court below found this, notwithstanding that the agreement in question does not in any explicit way preclude unilateral M&A activity by Martin Marietta.
Mr. Zimmett,
yes, Justice.
To clarify what the legal issues are, I'd like to ask a couple of questions to clear away the factual underbrush. The first is there any finding of fact made by the Chancellor that you're asking this court to overturn?
We don't need to ask this court to overturn a finding of fact.
So the answer is no.
The answer is it's not necessary, but there are two findings of fact that we think are erroneous, that are not the product of a logical deductive process,
you're
that are
not
supported
on
the record. This court does not need to overturn it.
You're not
in
asking
order.
The court to overturn them, are you?
I'm sorry if I'm not answering the question as directly.
Well, I've looked through your brief, and nowhere can I find an argument that says that any factual finding, is clearly wrong and therefore must be overturned. That's why I ask.
I understand that, but to the extent, Your Honor, that. And the two respects that I have in mind are the assertion that Martin Marietta deliberately chose to invoke.
No, I know you. I'm aware of those fly swats, but you're not asking us to kill it, are you?
Not in order to reverse.
All right. So we can assume that the facts are as the court found them. And that being the case, my next question or set of questions is this. There seem to be two operative terms that are relevant for our purposes on this appeal with respect to the confidentiality agreements. One of those terms is use and the other is disclose.
Yeah. Fair? They're both relevant. We are not asking the court to conclude. We are not disputing the finding of use on this appeal.
Okay, there was use of confidentiality materials and disclosure under both agreements. I understand the issue is whether that was permissible.
Yes, and use for purpose of pursuing an acquisition, we contend, is permitted. Disclosure, because the disclosures were legally required, is also permitted.
Okay, so the issue before us then is whether the use and the disclosure under both agreements was permitted.
That's correct, and we say it was because the contract explicitly contemplated, it talked about use, and it talked about use for evaluating a transaction between Martin Marietta and Vulcan. And it's on the word between that the trial court went wrong. Initially, because it determined that the word between necessarily meant a friendly, negotiated, reciprocal transaction. And the question that I would ask rhetorically is, when one reads the NDA, and confronts the word between as it's used in the NDA, does it occur to a reader from the plain reading of the language that the word between is was intended to be a proxy for negotiated friendly?
The terms of the contract that are legally at issue, you contend, or your side contends, are unambiguous and should be read as argued by Martin Marietta. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Is the non-ambiguity contention, which pervades all of your arguments, critical to those arguments?
It's important, but it's not dispositive, because even if the court were to conclude that between was intended to be a proxy for a consensual transaction, the offer in question is a consensual transaction because it is conditioned on approval by Vulcan's board. We don't believe the NDA limited Martin Marietta in that respect only to a transaction. And indeed, Your Honor, the court went further because it said not only are we going to conclude from the use of the word between that it was intended to be consensual, that it was intended to be friendly.
But that argument applies to the NDA, not the joint defense agreement.
Well, the joint defense agreement, paragraph 12, makes it totally subservient to the NDA.
Well, the JDA refers to a transaction under discussion or being discussed, words to that effect. Was at any time, was any hostile element of a takeover transaction under discussion?
The record doesn't show that there was ever a statement that Martin Marietta would or would not proceed on a non-negotiated basis. There was perfectly the opportunity for the...
You're saying it was not discussed.
That Martin Marietta did not forswear proceeding on an uninvited basis to Vulcan.
To the extent the transaction included a hostile exchange offer and a proxy contest, was that discussed?
It was not discussed that there would be a proxy contest. In fact, it was understood by Vulcan that their agreements did not prohibit a proxy contest. So was the testimony. But the point, more fundamentally, is with respect to the JDA and its relationship to the NDA, is that the JDA in paragraph 12 says that nothing herein shall limit, and I'm paraphrasing it, shall limit the rights and opportunities and prerogatives of Martin Marietta to do what it was entitled to do under the NDA. And when the NDA was entered into, the parties made a choice. Vulcan was aware, for example, that it had the right, because it had entered into a standstill agreement only 2 weeks before. It certainly knew about a standstill agreement, knew it could have asked for assurances that they wouldn't proceed. The contingency that when you enter into discussions and exchange of information with a potential M&A partner, that the other side might wish to act unilaterally is known to practitioners. The contingency was known to Vulcan. They had signed standstill agreements weeks before and months afterwards, and they didn't seek to get that protection here. They knew about the ability to restrict. They didn't seek it. They didn't think it was necessary, and so they left it out of the contract, and that is the contract that they have to abide by with Martin Marietta proceeding. The argument that Martin Marietta wanted to get the protection, that it was Martin Marietta who used elected to use the word between to document that the parties were committed to a friendly deal only, which is what the court found was premised on an assumption that Martin Marietta was trying to bring itself within the precedent of the Certicom case, which is a Canadian case. That makes no sense. There is nothing in the record. The record of how the NDA was drafted is complete. It was a terse exchange of emails between the two parties. There was no mention of Certicom. The draftsperson
doesn't really matter for purposes of this appeal. I mean, even if you're right counsel for Martin Marietta didn't have Certicom in her mind, never heard of it, never relied on it. Does it make any difference?
In the end, no, because but the word between is not an ambiguous term and does not connote or denote friendly. And if the parties intended to restrict themselves to a friendly, consensual deal, it would have been easy as pie to have used any of those words. And the fact that they didn't belies the stretch that was needed to say that we can find within the four corners of the NDA a commitment to a friendly deal, which is the finding that the trial court made. But then the trial court had another problem, because even if there was this meaning that should be ascribed to the word between of consensuality, the problem was, okay, Martin Marietta's offer is contingent on approval by the Vulcan board. They can't close their offer without it.
Now, to help me understand your position on why between is not ambiguous or should have the meaning you ascribe to it, how important to your interpretation of the word between is that conditionality? I think some transactional lawyers refer to it as a condition, that conditionality, that it was subject to approval by the Vulcan board.
I think, Mr. Chief Justice, that relates to two different points. That between the one question is between a proxy for consensual, and if one finds it not to be. Then it doesn't. Then we could have made an offer that is conditioned on Vulcan approval or not. It's only if one finds that there was an agreement that we proceed on a consensual basis that the fact that the offer is contingent on Vulcan approval comes into play.
Well, if there weren't this contingency that the Vulcan board approve it, would the transaction in the either exchange offer or a hostile tender offer, is that actually between the two corporate boards or corporations, or would it then be between Martin Marietta and the shareholders of Vulcan?
It would be between the two companies, but any M&A combination transaction between Vulcan and Martin Marietta necessarily involves at some point action by shareholders. I don't understand how in the types of transactions that we're talking about here in the combination of Martin Marietta and Vulcan it ever could be accomplished without some role for shareholders at some point, either accepting a cash tender offer or voting to approve a merger. But there's also a role for the two companies to play. And the word between, remember when the NDA was drafted, there was no agreement at all with respect to the form and structure and terms of what the transaction would be. So the word between was really meant to capture in a broad, generic way the probability or possibility of an M&A combination transaction between the two companies.
In whatever form.
In whatever form, but whatever form would necessarily at some point involve action by shareholders. And in fact, the difficulty that the trial court had and the difficulty that Vulcan had in trying to articulate what type of transaction would meet the definition of between is exemplified by the fact that they couldn't come up with a definition, and except for the one that was ultimately chosen, which is one that's approved up front by the two boards, but could be a merger or could be a proxy, until the midway through the post-trial argument, when they had advanced a number of different options for what type of transaction qualifies. And I think what that points out is sort of the folly of trying to, or the difficulty that a court has trying to draft a contractual term to give meaning to between and then give meaning to consensual and try and define it in ways that the parties had not. And it shows, I think, how length of contractual draftsmanship that was undertaken by the court that had not been undertaken by the parties when they simply said, okay, we're going to exchange information in connection with considering a transaction between us, and elected, for good or bad, not to restrict themselves. When they entered into the transaction, and I think Justice Jacobs, this may have been where I could have answered your question initially. When the parties undertook the discussions, there was a hope and an expectation that they would cut a deal, and it would be, in every colloquial sense of the word, friendly. That was the hope. But parties go into those discussions perhaps in that hope, but also armed with the knowledge that things might break down, that if they want to protect themselves against actions that could be taken a year later, they have the devices and the tools to do it, namely the standstill. Or they could have been more explicit in the NDA that they were being limited to a friendly transaction. But they didn't do any of those things. And so a year later, after Martin Marietta can't convince Vulcan management.
To express it in legal terms, and tell me if I have this right, your leading position is that the words transaction and between are unambiguous, and they do not capture any meaning or inference of friendly consensual transaction.
Absolutely.
Your alternative position is that even if that's wrong, this transaction is voluntary.
This transaction
would end up having to be an amount to involve an agreement between two boards, putting to one side that one of those boards now may be influenced or controlled by your side.
If we get to have four independent people elected, the answer to your question directly is yes. Though that summarizes the position.
Okay. If we were to reject your latter argument, the alternative argument, my question is the finding by the court of ambiguity with respect to both of these agreements fatal to your appeal? That is, must we find that the agreements are unambiguous in the manner that you argue in your briefs?
I don't believe you have to find that the word between is unambiguous, and that's the only finding of ambiguity that
well, that goes to your voluntary transaction argument.
Right.
The predicate of my question was, if we disagree with you on that, so let's put that to one side,
right,
is it essential that with respect to your other arguments we agree with your side's position that the critical terms in the two agreements are unambiguous?
It is not necessary to find the word between as being unambiguous, but if that finding is made and the contract is thought to require a consensual transaction, then it's necessary to find that what we have done is consensual. With respect to transaction, that is picked up by, you would have to agree that would be picked up by and governed by the NDA.
I would like to go to the disclosure end of this issue. Am I correct in understanding that even under your interpretation of the NDA, you would be subject to certain limitations on what you disclose?
Absolutely. We could not disclose, Justice Berger, anything that was not legally required.
Okay, so let's get to that for a moment. The trial court made a finding that Martin Marietta disclosed more than what was legally required, and therefore, even if everything else had been permissible, Martin Marietta breached the NDA by over-disclosing. I know that's not really a term, but and is that not at least partially a factual finding that we have to respect?
I don't think the court found that. The court criticized our disclosure, said it was imbalanced, but did not find, I don't believe, that the disclosures were not legally required. And that is a legal judgment that this court could, and to the determination of what is legally required is a determination that, this court can make de novo. But I don't believe the trial court found that our disclosures, yes, the court criticized it. Yes, the court said that you could have said something as glib as we had a couple of meetings, but I don't think the court said that the disclosures that we made were not in fact legally required. And they were in fact legally required because we pointed to the statutes, we pointed to the SEC comments which reviewed our disclosures and said we would like more. We pointed to the cases which said that the types of disclosures we made were required. And finally,
I'd like to ask you about that SEC comment that you just referred to, which includes this language: when such contractual or fiduciary relationships exist, abstention from trading may be the only alternative available to persons in possession of material non-public information, which will be both lawful and not in breach of the relationships.
Yes, it's perfectly possible for somebody to have contracted to put themselves in a box where they would agree, and some forms of standstill do this. They say, you won't take actions which will trigger disclosure requirements. But the critical difference here is what we did in making the offer, which permitted and necessitated the disclosures that were made, was an activity that was permitted. So it's not as if, so by virtue of taking permitted activity that the NDA contemplates, we were in a position where we were obliged under the securities laws to make the disclosures. They were legally required.
What's your position on the correlation between these legally required disclosures and notice before you did it?
It depends on the source. The answer to that, Justice Holland, is that there's a paragraph 3 and paragraph 4. Paragraph 4 is a disclosure regime that governs when you receive a subpoena or a notice from an agency to produce produce documents, and it specifies what you have to do in that circumstance. And that's something that that courts are familiar with dealing with. When people have confidentiality agreements, they receive subpoenas, there's a mechanism for dealing with it. Paragraph 3, which also contemplates disclosures which are legally required, does not, and it uses, it has the permissive language that you will not disclose except when legally required, operates perfectly in a scenario where, like an SEC disclosure, where you don't have, where the disclosure obligation is not triggered by an external demand. And it makes no sense because sometimes your disclosure obligations in that respect are immediate, where you have to disclose something immediately depending on the facts and circumstances. If I may, I have a minute and 27 seconds. I'd like to reserve some of that for rebuttal, but I'm at the court's disposition.
There are no other questions at this point. We'll save that time for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ted Mervis for Vulcan. If I may first thank the court for the opportunity to argue here today and to answer Justice Berger's question, at page 122 of the opinion, Chancellor Strine did in fact make a finding that Martin Marietta went beyond any definition legally required by over-disclosing, emphasis by the Court of Chancery, when it could have satisfied SEC requirements with a much simpler recitation. All in all, we submit this is a case that involves a happy coincidence of the facts, the law, the public policy, and the equities. But first and foremost is the standard of review. I think it's clear that non-ambiguity, that their position that the contracts are unambiguous as a matter of law on the two legal questions they proffer, the definition of transaction and the meaning of legally required in the interplay between paragraphs 3 and 4 of the NDA, is indeed essential to their position. Because the path they must take to seek a reversal after so thoroughly losing a trial, after the Chancellor found and identified 7 different ways that they had breached on both use and disclosure, and those facts we submit are not subject fairly to dispute or seriously to dispute in this court. 4-day trial, 16 witnesses, 800 exhibits. Fact-finding on use, both as to synergies and antitrust. Fact-finding on their disclosure. Disclosure first of the fact of the negotiations in direct violation of paragraph 3. As the Chancellor found, it was the Martin Marietta side that, to quote from page 2 of the opinion, evinced the most concern for confidentiality and who most feared having its willingness to enter into merger discussions become public. Disclosure, secondly, of Vulcan evaluation material and confidential information that they got under cover of these two confidentiality agreements. And then the finding that Martin Marietta, for its own tactical reasons, chose to use the S-4 in effect as a push piece for the hearts and minds of the activist communities and the stockholders in what the Chancellor found as a fact, quote from page 50, was a tactical decision influenced by its PR flex. By disclosures that he found were not legally required, were not even thought to be legally required by Martin Marietta, but were for tactical reasons to make Vulcan look bad. The Chancellor found as a fact, opinion at page 50 to 51, that the FLAC influence was evident in the S-4. The Chancellor found as a fact that, quote, this tactical use is clear and not the subject of any reasonable dispute. In the record at page A-160 is the transcript of a colloquy between the Chancellor and Mr. Nye, the CEO. Mr. Nye was asked by the Chancellor if what Martin Marietta did was sit down to think about what was legally required. Did you sit down with your lawyers and decide what the SEC required? Answer, no, sir, we did not. Mr. Nye was then asked, okay, is what happened that you all relied on what the Chancellor referred to as highly skilled flacks? Answer, yes, we did. That's at page A-160. I'll resist the temptation to say that it was a mixed question of flack and law. But the fact-finding was also that that Martin Marietta's use violated the JDA. The Chancellor found as a fact that neither Martin's exchange offer nor its proxy contest, and we didn't hear much about the proxy contest. The proxy contest couldn't possibly be thought of, we submit, as a business combination transaction between two companies. We'll come back. But the Chancellor found
The other side's argument is that you can't balkanize this transaction into hostile and non-hostile elements as long as the end result is consensual.
Well, that left, and the Chancellor considered that argument carefully, and that's when he made the comment that clearly no one thought you could get to a gunpoint transaction and have that be consistent with the terms of the NDA. And that's where they make the argument, what they call it, the dead hand argument. The Chancellor never found, and we certainly have never argued, that if the board were to change in a way that was not violative of either agreement, that new board could not then enter into a transaction that would be consistent with the NDA. That's not our position. And I don't believe it was the Chancellor's position. The Chancellor was simply saying, if you violate the confidentiality agreement by using information to mount a proxy contest, or in that proxy contest you make disclosure of information you're not allowed to disclose, and then you change the board, then we think you do have to consider the proxy fight and the and the exchange offer as one kettle of fish, as one, as a single program, as indeed they both announced them together on December 12th. And then when it came to extrinsic evidence, and this is really, I think, the legal issue before the court, did the chancellor err as a matter of law by finding the agreements sufficiently ambiguous that the chancellor decided to look at extrinsic evidence? The chancellor did find the agreements ambiguous. We think, frankly, that he gave Martin Marietta the benefit of every doubt and found things ambiguous that we never thought were ambiguous. But he did, and he looked at extrinsic evidence, and he made findings, and those findings as well are subject under CD to the clear error rule and can only be overturned if they're clearly erroneous. And he found as a fact that the limitation of use to a quote-unquote transaction as defined, a business combination between Vulcan and Marietta contemplated, he considered, did that contemplate the right for either side unilaterally to turn around and go hostile on the other? And was the out for legally required in paragraph 3, could that seriously be thought to entitle Martin Marietta at any point to make a tender offer, subject itself to SEC legal requirements, and then choose to decide for itself and by itself what to disclose? Consider how extreme Martin Marietta's position is and has to be before this court. They are saying that at any time after two public companies, competitors no less, sign confidentiality agreements, sit down to have conversations, it's their position that at any time either one could stand up at the negotiating table, rip up both agreements, and say, well, I'm making a hostile tender offer and starting a proxy fight using your information, because at the end of the day, we're hopeful that there'll be an agreement at some point, but right now it's hostile. Make a hostile proxy fight and a hostile tender offer and disclose to the world all the information we'd agreed to keep secret. They could do that at any time.
Well, is your position the opposite, that there's a standstill by virtue of the confidentiality?
Absolutely not. It's not our position that it's a standstill. A standstill is a very different animal. If two parties sign a standstill agreement, then the minute they sign it, they're stopped out. If you sign a confidentiality agreement with a use restriction and a confidentiality restriction, you can sign that agreement, and if you receive no information, or if you use no information, or if you disclose no information and you're not allowed to, all hostile options are still on the table. That's why many parties, in fact, prefer confidentiality agreements to standstill agreements. And the history in Certicom is exactly, that's exactly what happened. First, Certicom and RIM signed a standstill agreement. And RIM got no information from Certicom. It got handcuffs. It was forced to stand still. It couldn't do make a hostile move, but it got no information. When it expired, the parties then decided to enter into a confidentiality agreement. And parties often in the M&A world prefer confidentiality agreements. Their refrain is always, well, you could have had a standstill agreement. Yes, we could have had a standstill agreement. They didn't want to have a standstill agreement. They didn't have a standstill agreement. Just because there was no standstill provision in the agreement, clearly we submit, doesn't mean you don't enforce the provisions that are in the agreement. A standstill, the key difference is, if you sign a confidentiality agreement, then and there's a hostile activity that we think is in violation, we had to prove use. We had a four-day trial. We proved use. We had to prove disclosure of information provided under the agreement. We proved it. We may have overproved. We proved it. That's the difference. A standstill is an automatic thing. It's the mere signing of a confidentiality agreement doesn't take any hostile options off the table unless you violate the specific provisions you agree to. That's why we think their refrain about a standstill agreement is essentially an irrelevancy. And I think the court of chance. Yes.
Let's get back to the way you read this agreement and the way the court ultimately read this agreement. Wouldn't you have to agree that the way the court has interpreted it, the word between these two companies means a negotiated transaction between these two companies?
Yes.
And that's not in the agreement. Lots of good lawyers involved in drafting the agreement. Why should the court, the trial court, or this court affirm something that is a reaching out and adding to the provisions of a carefully negotiated agreement. And both you and the trial court made the argument that it's very important for the world out there that confidentiality agreements have teeth and are valid and enforceable and so forth. And yet at the flip side of that, which arguably is equally important, is that parties to contracts ought to know that if they use plain language, a court isn't going to jump in and say, well, wait a second, this is ambiguous and I want to find out what the parties really had in mind despite what they actually wrote.
Indeed, Your Honor. And let me say, I don't think it's fair to say that the Chancellor relied solely on the word between, and neither do we. What the Chancellor faced and what he was entitled to consider under this court's precedence and whether or not the contract was ambiguous, he was entitled to look at the four corners of the contract. Under this court's decision in Lorillard, he was entitled to consider the business context. The court put it to determine what a reasonable person in the position of the parties would have thought the language means. In other words, the court was entitled to say, to think, I'm reading a contract, not in a vacuum, I'm reading a contract between two public companies or competitors who are sitting down to exchange confidential information. And the court was also entitled to consider the background legal context, as this court did in Airgas, and indeed, in Your Honor, Justice Holland's most recent opinion in Savage Sports, the same point was made, when the court said in that case that the parties who contract know how contract language has been construed, in that case by Delaware courts, by courts in general. So the question the court considered was, is a hostile tender offer and proxy fight unambiguously a business combination transaction between Martin Marietta and Vulcan? And I submit, how could that be unambiguously so? The proxy fight was not even claimed to be a transaction of any kind. The Delaware court in Home Shopping Network held that a tender offer is not a business combination under 203. Different context, no doubt, same words. The Certicom court had held that a tender offer is not between the two contracting parties. Certicom may have been right or wrong. I submit that's not the question before the court. But it wasn't nuts. It can't be that the same words that the Certicom court said meant friendly can only mean what Mark Marietta says they mean. Would a reasonable person sign a confidentiality agreement to share confidential information, think that the other side was then free to use the information against it at any time? Confidentiality agreements are not suicide pacts. Could the language have been clearer? No doubt. Any contract can be clear. It could have said negotiated, friendly, rapturous, whatever. But that, I submit, is not the question. The question is, was it unambiguous in Martin Marietta's favor? And on that, I submit it was not. Unambiguous that either side could go hostile on the other using confidential information just exchanged in friendly negotiations? Their reply brief does a piece on my partner, Mr. Kerman's treatise. And yes, Mr. Kerman recommends using the word negotiated. Good advice. But that doesn't mean that if you leave out the word, it clearly and only means hostilities are okay. So the Chancellor said, I don't know. I can't tell from the words. So he looked at extrinsic evidence. And what did he find when he looked at extrinsic evidence? He found, clear as a bell, only a friendly deal was contemplated. He found that their CEO, Mr. Nye, was focused like a laser beam on avoiding anything that might put his company in play. He found that their general counsel, who consulted with her outside lawyers at Skadden. So the notion of whether or not Rosalind Barr ever read Certicom, she consulted with Skadden. Certicom had just come down 2 weeks before. And she's the one who changed the words transaction involving, which was a much looser formulation, to business combination between. And the Chancellor found that that connoted, quote, a requirement of reciprocal action, not a forced invasion of one party by the other. And then the court also looked at Martin Marietta's out-of-court conduct. How did it act before it brought this lawsuit, before it went hostile? It showed, its own action showed that it indeed thought that hostile use was a no-no. The general counsel boxed up all the information.
Well, couldn't that have been also just to avoid a potential issue? rather than an admission?
Well, but if their position is unambiguity, clear as a bell, that they were entitled to go hostile, why all these comments? Why the boxing up? Why the investment banker's concern? I don't know. One of the bankers wrote an email. I don't know if we can use this information. None of that made any sense, we submit, if it was really so unambiguous to the very party who signed the agreement that they were entitled to go hostile. Yes, they do say, well, another way to explain it is they were trying to avoid contentious issues. Well, that's not what the vice chancellor, that's not what the chancellor found.
In your view, counsel, what does the requirement that the Vulcan board consent to the combination at the end of the day add to the business combination between language?
Nothing.
I Nothing. Thought you might say that, but can you explain why?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, because, first of all, the merger condition that they have in their tender offer has nothing to do, first of all, with the proxy fight. There's nothing consensual, or at the end of the day, consensual about the proxy fight. And as the chancellor held and noted, the condition was waivable at any time. Indeed, they brought a lawsuit in New Jersey State Court for the very purpose of getting the of seeking a declaration that they were entitled to waive that condition and still be not covered by the New Jersey Shareholder Protection Act. And the footnote argument that they make to this court, that they had, that counsel had made a representation that it will commit not to waive, well, leave the anti-footnote rule aside, they never did commit, and they still have never committed not to waive or amended their offer to take it out. The chancellor, we submit, correctly brushed that off. And indeed, because, as I said, Martin went so far as to sue us in New Jersey to get the right to waive. But the point at the end of the day is, and Mr. Zimmet said, at the end of every day, at the end of every fight, there's probably a deal at the end. But that's not the point. The point is, the confidentiality agreement was designed to protect the parties from a fight by the others using their information at the, to put them in a gunpoint position, as the chancellor noted. I don't think it's fair to say, well, we can, you know, we can beat you up, we can use your information against you, we can disclose everything we said we would never disclose, because at the end of the day, after you're beaten, bloodied, and on the floor, we expect to shake your hand.
Would you agree that the way this NDA has been construed, it does, in fact, include a standstill?
No, I
would. Why not?
I would agree with this. The way it's been construed, coupled with the finding of use, and coupled with the finding that there was disclosure of information not permitted to be disclosed, it has the same effect as a standstill, given their own conduct.
What if there hadn't been over-disclosure? Wouldn't there still be a standstill?
Yes. If there would be a standstill in the sense that if they use the information, if they violated the use restriction, or if they violated the disclosure restriction, they're in breach of contract. Just like under a standstill, if you make a hostile act, regardless of what information you have or don't have or use or don't use, you breach the contract. Only in that respect, Your Honor, are the two similar. But there is...
Well, I'm getting lost here. Tell me how this NDA does not function as a standstill.
Okay. As the day after the contracts were signed, these NDAs,
mm-hmm.
if there would have been no exchange of information...
Well, let's assume the information's been exchanged.
Oh. If the information's been exchanged, if there's been no use of the information by the Martin Meredith side, for example, if they used a clean team, what the court referred to in Certicom, or if they found some way to isolate the information and not make use of it by people deciding what to do, they were perfectly free to go hostile. Perfectly free. If they had signed a standstill on day one, they would not be.
So you're saying that a party that's in possession of confidential information about another company's financial prospects and business plans and so forth can go ahead and make purchases of that stock?
There may be legal prohibitions that it's subject to, in the same way there may be antitrust prohibitions, there may be all kinds of prohibitions, but as a matter of pure contractual prohibition, the nub of the difference between a confidentiality agreement and a standstill agreement is that a confidentiality agreement, in order to be breached, the party on our side of the caption has to prove that there was use of the information in violation of a specific term, or that there was disclosure of the information in violation of a specific term. If you sign a standstill agreement, the burden of proving those things is gone. That's why some people prefer standstills. Some people prefer not to take on the burden of having to prove use or prove improper disclosure.
So the standstill agreement is really a global prohibition on taking any hostile act, whereas the confidentiality agreement does not, by its own terms, prohibit a hostile act as long as there's no prohibited use or disclosure.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And I would submit that there's nothing new here. There are no surprises. This is an eyes wide open, no gotcha case. It's not just Certicom. The practice guides, the M&A literature, all make it clear that signing confidentiality agreements can impose limitations on what you can do. The Klingon-Nugent treatise that we cite, and they say that's all. They say that we only cited the section that talks about disclosure, and they can get out of that because they have their fancy legally required argument that the chancellor rejected. Well, that's wrong. Section 902 of that treatise also says that the use restriction in practice is quite important. Why? Because it can be a backdoor way to impose a standstill on the buyer. Why? Quote, the seller can argue that the buyer improperly used the confidential information in making a bid. Everybody in the field understands that. If you sign a confidentiality agreement without it that does not have an explicit standstill, you can sign it, and the next day you can be as hostile as you like. But if you receive confidential information and you use it, you will have violated the contract. The mere fact that a contract doesn't have a certain provision in it, we submit, doesn't mean that a court should not enforce the provisions that are in it. And the court and the chancellor dealt with this at great length. And I think it's fair to say, was very careful to separate out. And if it wouldn't have been for the finding of use, and if it wouldn't have been for the finding of the way the chancellor read paragraphs 3 and 4, which we submit is the only way to read them, given that the general counsel of Martin Marietta added the words subject to paragraph 4 at the beginning of paragraph 3, and that's all laid out in the briefs. I only have a minute, and if I'd just like to turn briefly, unless the court has other questions, to the question of relief on appeal. In their reply brief, for the first time, Martin Marietta requests a rather extravagant form of relief. They ask this court, to reinstate their nominees and to enjoin us, Vulcan, and requiring us, in effect, to put off our annual meeting tomorrow until July 16th. There was none of this in their opening brief. Their opening brief only asked the court to reverse, to dissolve the injunction, to rule that they had not breached the agreements, and that be allowed to resume their activities. Under Supreme Court Rule 14, that's it. No sandbagging. But there's more than that. They sought a stay in the Court of Chancery after they lost, so they would not have to withdraw their director nominees. They lost. The chancellor denied their stay. They did not even seek a stay in this court. The situation they find themselves in today, Your Honors, we submit, is largely self-inflicted. But to come into this court now in a reply brief and ask for an order reinstating their directors and enjoining us is just plain wrong. But more fundamental than that, even, what they're asking the court to do would inject this court into all manner of issues that are not in this case. Vulcan is a New Jersey corporation. Vulcan's bylaws requires 90 days advance notice. That's in the record at B521. That's now impossible. The shoulder meeting is tomorrow. There is no warrant, we submit, for this court to encroach on or set aside those bylaws that are governed by New Jersey law. The meeting has long been set. Under the New Jersey statute, the record date becomes stale on June 19th. And even beyond all that, what has Martin Marietta told the world? They told the world on May 7th, when they lost in the Court of Chancery, that that was just a speed bump. No reparable injury, just a speed bump. They publicly said that they, quote, intend to continue its efforts to combine with Vulcan as soon as permitted to do so. And that's at B541. So we submit And the chancellor was sensitive to this concern. I see my time's up. And I don't think it's appropriate for Martin Marietta to even make that ask in this court, much less the fact that, obviously, I think it's not, appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, very briefly, the subject to language with respect to paragraph 3 and paragraph 4, I would ask the same question I posed with respect to between. When one reads the language, isn't it plain that the reference in subject 2 in paragraph 3 is really to that limited class of transactions that are peculiarly within the procedures that paragraph 4 contemplates, namely subpoenas, subpoenas and such. Counsel also addressed the question of whether or not there is what we have termed the stealth standstill here, and there is the way they would construe it. They would construe this NDA, which does not use words of limitation, friendly or consensual, which does not have an express standstill, which permits us to use the information to evaluate a transaction, and which permits us to make legally required disclosures. So all the conduct that we are engaging in, we say, is contemplated within the plain language of the contract. They say, nonetheless, constitutes a standstill, and that makes no sense. When we are pursuing transactions that the contracts permit, we ought to be able to do it. And then with respect to the, we asked, may I have 15 seconds?
All right.
Thank you. We asked the trial court for a stay, pending appeal. They said, the trial court said no. We asked, would you delay it so that we could go to the Supreme Court? The answer was no, we must act immediately. And because we were required to act immediately, we withdrew our proxies, and that's why we need the court to reinstate things. I appreciate the courtesy. Thanks for the opportunity to argue this case.
Thank you, counsel. Just before we recess, I would ask that a representative of each side please give a cell phone number to the clerk. With that in mind, we'll take the case under advisement and recess.